Welcome back to Game Time. I'm your host, Shauna Griffiths. And as always, we are having a conversation with an impactful leader. He is one of the first draft class leadership athletes. He is a dear friend of mine and someone who I hold in such high regard. And so I am welcoming to the show Dan Lefton, who I really just call Lefton. So get used to it. Welcome.
Shauna, so great to see you, and great to be with you.
Thank you. So, folks, I always tell you how I know my guests. So, Lefton and I worked at the Nets, then New Jersey Nets, years ago. And I was, I don't know, doing craziness in marketing. I always talk about steam coming out of my computer. I feel like it was coming out of my ears as well. And Lefton was always such a force of calm, and it was a safe space when things were going crazy or good or whatever. I remember slinking down to your office sometimes and being like, "Hi." So he was at that time leading in the client client services, ticket services,
Yeah,
ticket
exactly. Nailed it.
services. And I left the year before Brooklyn Barclays Center opened. And that is, I will say to you, that is one thing in my career that I regret, which we'll get back to. But now, Lefton, you are the EVP and Chief Revenue Officer at the Detroit Pistons, running a lot of things. You've had a remarkable career. And so I'm really grateful to have you here today, and I'd love for you to tell us about what you're doing right now. Root us in what's going on at the Pistons.
Sure. Sean, it's great to be with you. And one little anecdote before I jump into my background. So you mentioned those New Jersey Nets days. And there were often times where you and I would commiserate or even, brainstorm the craziest of craziest ideas, which is bound to happen in a Brett Yormark universe. I was always taken, we would have our staff meeting and Shauna would take notes with a Sharpie. Now, this also acted as like a smelling salt of sorts, so it would keep me alert during the meeting. But I was like, she is a really, really confident person because there's no editing these notes; they're in Sharpie. So it's always stuck with me. You're a one of one in a lot of ways, but that was something I've taken with me all these years.
I'm telling you what my preferred writing utensil is now, still to this day, a black Sharpie.
I love it. You see?
I always have them. John's always like, more Sharpies, my husband. Anyway, that is hilarious. I love that that stood out. That's amazing.
Yes, and it was like a confidence that I always felt that it portrayed a lot of confidence. So
Okay.
my current role, I work for the Detroit Pistons. I'm our chief revenue officer, and under my purview is all of our ticketing verticals. So ticket sales, retention, premium. Group sales. I also have corporate partnerships. So it's partnership sales, it's activation, it's solutions. The one vertical that maybe is a little bit non-traditional for a chief revenue officer, our business intelligence unit is under my purview, and that's data and analytics. And for me, it's aspirational. That team, I really want them to serve as almost an agency of record for the organization, providing support and resources throughout. So, and I'm going into or almost completing my fourth season, second stint with the Pistons.
It's amazing. I was going to ask about, we'll definitely talk about the second stint. But that's amazing. And that is all. I love what you're talking about, having that area under you as well. I mean, it makes just so much sense connected to the sponsorship sales, the ticket sales element of it. And then you said you're in your fourth season, but folks, I mean, can we talk about what's going on with the Detroit Pistons this year on the court? What a turnaround. I mean, it must be amazing to be a part of.
It's absolutely incredible, especially when you think about where we came from. The last decade, there hasn't been nearly as much winning as the organization was blessed with the previous few decades. And when you think about the last three seasons, so coming out of the pandemic, being back to full capacity, we in aggregate had the worst record in all of sports, worst winning percentage. And yet still found a way to set revenue records and do a lot of wonderful things in the community. But winning certainly, I tell everyone You know, success has so many different mothers and fathers, and failure is an orphan. And we all look a lot smarter this year. Everything seems to taste better in the arena. But it really, so much credit starts at the top, having an ownership group and just a braveness in our owner, Tom Gores, making a really tough decision last offseason on making sweeping changes that financially, I mean, we had a coach that was literally in the first year of a $67.5 million contract. And he brings in someone like Trajan Langdon, who I had the pleasure of working with in Brooklyn. He was our assistant general manager. And Trajan, from a basketball standpoint, is a savant, but also just his approach as a CEO and a leader of people leaned heavily into culture. And I know that word gets thrown around really loosely, but, you know, putting those words into action and building out a team under him with some people that have more experience than him, that have sat in the chair before him. And I think a lot of what he's successfully done on the basketball side is really transferable to the business side as well. And overall, Detroit in general is an awesome market. It's a great sports town. It supports not only its professional teams, but really supports the college teams as well. And, you know, to be able to have a team this year that coming off a season where we won 14 games and we're in a position to triple or go even higher than that, our win total, it's really out of nowhere and been so much fun to really see it through the lens of the fans as well.
Yeah, it's got to be so awesome to be a part of that swing. I mean, because you and I were at the Nets together when we had a very non-winning season, let's just call it that. And it becomes so challenging. But I remember you and I talked about this last year when we saw each other, that the difference that helps you get through those deep lulls when business isn't usually going well, if it's not going well in the court, it really comes down to the people, the leadership. And you're right, people throw around the word culture when it's just words, or people are saying that we don't have this culture that we want. But the reality is, just as you're saying, it comes from people's actions in leadership seats. I think we both felt that definitely with like Fred Mangione and some of the other people that we had there. And it's so great to hear that that's part of the recipe for success that you're seeing with the Pistons.
It's an excellent point. The people part of this business, it's not only just a relationship business, but if you nail hiring and you get that piece right, everything else feeds off of that. And it allows you to be in a situation. You can't control wins and losses on the floor. And you could put, I've seen super teams created and an injury derails it, or it just, the pieces don't fit. And our former boss and CEO, Brett Yormark at the New Jersey Nets, used to always say to us, we don't sell wins and losses, we sell fun. We suffered through a 12-70 season. That year we were trying our best to sell a lot of fun. But it was really the people. We leaned on each other because it shouldn't matter as much as it does, but it does play into your mental health and you're coming into the office every day. And those outreaches, especially in a sales chair, similar last year, each day, those are challenging conversations because you're either hearing about how bad the team is or you're anticipating, right? And it's kind of that defense mechanism before you even go into a call. So it's super important. I've been very fortunate throughout, you know, my 26 years in the industry that most of the organizations I've worked for have had a great culture. Most of the organizations that I've been a part of have really been supportive of this mindset of let's get the best people possible. And yes, let's operate within a traditional org chart, but it doesn't have to be cookie cutter. If you find talent or there's a blend or a mix, because I think diversity of thought is super important. Who are people that are going to really work well and collaborate, but also challenge each other? Shauna, you and I didn't always agree on things. I think probably some of the best conversations that we had were ones where we maybe saw things differently. And maybe you were looking at it through a marketing lens, and I was looking at it through only a revenue driving lens. And then we kind of stepped back and we said, okay, where does that alignment exist? And then ultimately, sometimes it's compromise too. Hey, why don't we try to navigate it your way this time? And then the next time, okay, let's A/B test even something. So I think having that type of mindset, creating a culture where you want people to swing big. And when people swing big, there's going to be failures. And I think that's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. You know, we use our social platform so often to say how wonderful things are. Very rarely do we send a post, came up with this initiative, it was a huge dud, we spent a lot of money on it, a lot of men and women hours were spent. But to me, I've learned so much in my career on things that I was so passionate about, and maybe they missed the mark, or maybe they needed a recalibration. And the collaboration, somebody maybe even came prior and said, here's a few concerns, let's work through them before we put it out into the marketplace.
Yeah, that collaboration is so key. And frankly, as I was saying to you earlier, it's something that I've always thrived on. And, you know, that was one of the things I loved about the environment, like you're talking about, that we had. There was so much cross collaboration. There was also an element, you said that you felt fortunate in your career to have been in mostly healthy cultures. One of the things that I talk about anytime I'm talking to someone who was in that era with us is I actually feel fortunate that as a female, I didn't run into a lot of the same challenges that a lot of other females did coming up at that time and still are. I truly always felt valued, equal, though my gender was never part of it. And I know you believe very strongly in supporting females and diversity. With you, is it so genuine? It's not because that's what you're supposed to say. I've watched you do it. You know, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Laura, your wife, who is a total rock star. She was with us at the Nets. She's killing it in very senior level at the NFL league office. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about why that's a conscious effort for you and how that's a part of your culture that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's great to hear that. And you know, I appreciate it because it is something that's always been ingrained in me, you know, being a great champion for diversity and especially women in leadership roles. I do think there's a lot of women that still find it challenging to ascend in certain verticals, maybe revenue-based verticals, ones that I've spent the majority of my career in. And I see that in league meetings, right? There's way more people that look like me than you in senior level chairs. But I take it back to kind of the environment I was raised in. My dad and mom were really huge influences in my life. And my mom was, you know, a really, she worked in real estate and she was a bulldog. And I think powerful women, I've just always been around in my career. I've had several women bosses. My first at the Pistons, Sarah Daniel, is still doing it in Carolina. You know, and so that's always been ingrained in me, but also I think you referenced Laura, my wife, who's been a huge instrumental driving force in a lot of the success I've been fortunate to have, in that Laura has, you know, taken on a role that traditionally hasn't been occupied by women, and seeing her advancement versus mine and some of the roadblocks she encounters, even things that maybe are more nuanced, she's referred to as a working mom. No one ever refers to me as a working dad. And, you know, when you start looking at pay banding and advancement in other opportunities in other organizations, they haven't always been as readily available. So it's making a conscious decision and leaning into it. And it is, you still are hiring the best, most qualified person. You're just casting a wider net. Or you're providing that opportunity for somebody that maybe hasn't been in that specific role, but has led somewhere else. And I think the more that we can break those stereotypes and those stigmatisms and give those opportunities, because I can mentor, I can champion this type of thought, But if I'm talking and recruiting somebody that's a young female, she might believe in me. I might inspire her completely, but she can't picture herself as the next me in a lot of ways. And that for me was a little bit tough to realize at times. Also, that sometimes some of the younger women that I would mentor would gravitate towards other women in the space. And, you know, that's where I think Laura kind of gave me that aha moment too. It's like, yeah, don't take it personally. Like, put your ego aside. They're trying to envision themselves in that chair. And it's just, like I said, it's been a real conscious effort, but it's also, I think it just yields, like, we're going after a segment of the population from a fandom standpoint where we want it to be overarching. You know, I think the North Star is everybody's looking, how do we capture a younger fan base? How do we capture a more diverse fan base? Well, it's certainly helpful if you have some people in your organization that can speak directly to that segment that you're going after.
Totally. And I love the way we're talking about this, because this is so much what that's been a driving force behind this show, even me with the Leadership Athletes, is to elevate those of you. To me, it's a form of representation in the seat of leadership. You can look at someone who does look and sound like you, and you, because of the way you operate from a very intentional, aware space, and you're making these choices every day because that's what matters to you, you know? And I love the way you talk about that. And the other element we were talking about is the nuances. So has it affected me that I am a female as I've tried to, you know, pursue my own career? Absolutely. And my point is that when I was working around people like you, Fred, Aslo, Verna, all of you, I didn't feel that it was being used against me, so to say. And so again, that's why I truly feel, you know, fortunate. I also realized when I left that you didn't necessarily realize how great the leadership was that you had. And I didn't step away because of leadership. I stepped away because in my own brain, I thought I needed something else. But then you get other places and you see the way other people are operating and you're like, oh, shit. So I learned a hard lesson about that. And I think it's just really important as you're going forward, if you're looking for great leadership, is really be aware of the leadership you have or the leadership that you're about to step into.
Yeah, well said. I think sometimes we get in an environment, and when you're living through something that's really great, you sometimes don't realize how good it is. I think also if we're, you know, looking back too, there is this element of romanticizing as well. And then I think about even generational differences as well, and how that all plays into it, because in the current environment with the Pistons, I think there's a lot of really thoughtful, we try to be empathetic in a lot of things we do. And then you'll hear sometimes things that bubble back as constructive feedback and you go, whoa, like that's not how we intended it. And then by the same token, someone else that maybe has the experience of being a few other places says, oh my God, they don't realize how good they have it. And I go, that's awesome. You should tell that person that, because it's not going to mean the same if it comes from me, who's, you know, people view me as senior leadership being maybe a little bit biased. Of course, I'm going to say we have a great culture, right? I'm one of the, you know, key components or elements of trying to drive that culture on a daily basis.
Yeah. When you're talking about so many like layers of, I guess, generation, that's something that I have been hearing so much from leaders, is just the reality that you have so many layers in an organization working together right now that are of different generations. And I don't mean layers as in bureaucracy, but you may have some people that still have seats that are in their 70s. And then, you know, you're going down all the way to the youngest people who might be your interns in college. And that's a lot of different generations that are still in the workforce. We came up joking around about the person who was like, can you make this a PDF for me? But, you know, now things have come so much further. I'm like terrified I'm going to be the person that's like, what is this AI thing?
Exactly. Aging out or not staying relevant. It's, you know, just on our ticket sales team, for example, I have a woman that's been doing it, Susan Zayed, and she's been selling tickets for the Detroit Pistons for 35 plus years. Okay. So you have that element. And then I've got others that are just out of school and I'm meeting their parents at a game and I'm older than their parents. So it's, yeah, you overnight you feel like a dinosaur. And I think what I have found really with this up and coming generation that's in the workforce now is they're far more inquisitive. They want to know the why behind things way more. I think when you and I were just cutting our teeth, it was this fear or, hey, we should fall in line. It's a little bit more like a military operation. Don't go above my actual manager. Like it was really kind of taboo to go two layers above. And, you know, I think the pendulum has shifted and in some ways really positive. It's, you know, it's not the end all be all working 20 hours a day or, you know, people want to have more of that work-life balance. And I think the romanticism of working in sport has dimmed a little bit. I think the pandemic contributed to that. People wanting to be in an office versus having hybrid work. And, you know, so that helps contribute a little bit to the overall calculus in terms of what we're seeing today in the workforce. But again, it comes to, I always believe in having a really diverse subset of people within the organization really allows you to have kind of this fresh perspective. And to your point, it's, you know, you don't want to age out. And if the new and cutting trend, it's like, okay, I want to be well-versed in that and stay current.
Yeah. I was actually just talking about this yesterday, but I went back to our time at the Nets when everybody else was on social media at the time. And I was like, yeah, no, not so much. But I've gotten on it over time. And sometimes I might want to go off of it just because of the inundation of information. But it is that part of, I don't want to age out. I don't want to get irrelevant. I want to make sure that I'm hearing from and learning from just how consumers of all these ages are operating now. So I totally hear you. I thought earlier when you were talking about notes, speaking of devices and tech and all that, I thought you were talking about the notes I used to take on my BlackBerry.
Well, that too. I do miss the BlackBerry. I remember at my wedding, which you were at, that my dad got up and said a few words and he referenced that this is the longest that Laura and I had ever been off of our BlackBerries was during the ceremony. So you know, now it's transitioned to an iPhone, but it's still pretty much the same customer.
Sure. I was like, oh God, what did I do on my BlackBerry at your wedding? Such craziness. But while we're on technology, and I'm curious, in the ticketing space or in the corporate sales space that you're under, are there any like new technologies that are using that you think is like it? You know, you really appreciate or you have really changed the game in this space for you?
Yeah, I think always emerging, AI is a big, big buzzword these days, right? And, you know, I would argue that a lot of us have been using AI for several decades. And whether it's logging onto a website and there being a chatbot function, but it's really data science in terms of how do you make things even more efficient, right? How do you, and on the fan and customer experience, there's this frictionless experience where you go to an event now, you can just walk in, it's scanning you, it can collect payment. You've probably seen some of the devices where you put your items down, scans you, but there's still a human element, right? There's still somebody there in case anything were to go awry. From a tech specific to the verticals that, you know, I oversee, ticketing's been one, and it probably was a driving force right after Barclays Center opened. The first year after the building opened in 2013, I think there was some surprise when I approached them about leaving and starting my own company. I felt like ticketing was really ripe for positive disruption. I love positive disruption. I think about these companies. And people that know me well, I'm always referencing Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Tesla as these disruptor brands that came into these established markets and really helped make it a better experience. And for ticketing, it's this whole concept of open distribution. How do you make things more readily available to consumers and customers? And yeah, there's a monetization component on that, but you know, from a ticketing perspective, so much the teams are trying to drive you to their app. And then it's, what can you do within the app? And then you look at other products, right? Fanatics is a great example where they're trying to incorporate the journey in terms of, oh, you went there wanting to buy a hat. Next thing you know, you're checking out with 8 items in your cart. And it's a t-shirt. And heck, they're giving you, serving up betting credits. And, you know, I think ticketing has the same opportunity, especially organizations that own and operate their own venue. There's an F&B component. There's the merch component, where it all can live as a, you know, extension of the ticket or a rewards platform or suggestive. Nothing Amazon serving you up products that you never even dreamed of that you wanted or needed. And then all of a sudden, it kind of, you think about it or it shows up, and next thing you know, 2 clicks, not only did you order it, within 2 hours, it's at your doorstep. It's incredible. I think on the partnership side, a lot of the brands that we work with, or the brands that we're trying to work with, they want to understand, you know, the first party data and what that means for the experience of fans. We're all consuming content and data differently. And I'm really guilty of this, and I think a lot of other people are as well. It used to be when, before you went to bed, maybe you were reading a book or listening to music, watching TV, whatever it might be. Now I find myself scrolling, and you sometimes can go into a black hole, whether you're on X or Instagram, and the next thing you know, it's 45 minutes later, you haven't gone to bed, you haven't unwound, but these devices, this is where content, this is where brand is being served up. And it's super important that as an organization, we think about how do we not only get the eyeballs, but build out that engagement. And I think back to a couple decades ago when these platforms first came about, it was, how many users do you have, right? And that question gets asked a lot less versus impressions and engagement. You know, from a database building, it's what are your open rates? You want to A/B test some things. So I think that overall has been a big shift that a lot of brands are educated as well. A lot of these brands now are repped by agencies, and it's either agency to agency, or we're almost negotiating with an agency versus the brand directly.
Yeah. So listening to you talk about it, I was thinking about the experience that I had when I came to a game last year. Folks, if you can get to a Pistons game, it was awesome. I had so much fun. You could just feel the excitement. And I think it also has to do with the revival that's going on in Detroit as well. And there's just a general excitement and enthusiasm. And I'm so glad to hear that it's seeping into how you're doing your ticketing and your corporate partnerships. That's amazing.
It has been great. You and I were back in the day where when the teams weren't winning as much, you sell fun, you sell the experience. Fortunately, the product on the court is fantastic. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of competition for the dollar nowadays, and also just a family friendly environment as well. And also all the optionality and knowing people are all tied to their devices. Sports betting has become a big part of the landscape as well. And it's, how do you integrate all of this into the experience? And it's no different than when we were together in New Jersey, you know, back in 2007, and Brett Yormark was saying the street to seat experience, and then Brooklyn. Well, it's no different. If somebody has a hard time parking in our parking garage, right? It's not like Brooklyn where people were using mass transit. People drive in Detroit to the game. If that first experience is not a positive one, or they're walking in and the person greeting them isn't warm and friendly and engaging, so you went through all of this to get somebody to come out to the game. They probably paid a little bit more than they expected for the ticket. It's, you know, all of that matters. And then when they're finally at the game, how does it become this memorable experience? And that's changed for me. Right. I used to want to be at these big events. Laura and I would go to these events. We enjoyed it. We We love music. We'd go to concerts. We'd go to sporting events together, even working in the industry. Now, it's all through the lens of my kids. Are my kids having a great time? Am I creating an experience for them that the next morning they're waking up and saying, "Dad, that was an amazing night." Like, that's, if you get that right with me, you've won our family over. And, you know, that's the portion, depending on who the fan is or who you're bringing out, that initiative and, you know, how that measurable is a little bit different from person to person.
Yeah. And understanding that what you're just talking about is all those things that motivate a person who's the buyer is really important. It's not always just about what's serving them directly as a person. That's a perfect example. People want to be able to say, my kid got this experience. Or so, yeah, it's definitely true. And I think even coming out of the pandemic, I know we talked about that a little bit. I think it's only been increasing the amount that consumers are looking for that experience in whatever they're buying. It doesn't seem like it's any longer just like a thing. You want to buy a simple thing. Most of the thing has to have some sort of experience tied to it.
Absolutely. And there was that fear, right? The world shuts down and people are saying to themselves, will I ever want to be in a crowd that large again? And there's been a boom in terms of, if you look across all the leagues, NBA in particular, attendance is up. And continues to be up. It sets records. Viewership across the NFL and other sports, they're setting records. And it's, fans are craving and really have that huge desire for live content, right? You just never know what's going to happen. Games are exciting. There's something about being there. Now, the being there, and in terms of creating kind of those FOMO opportunities, maybe that has changed a little bit in how you really reach people and get that sustainability. Because I think sustainability is something that's super important too. As we think about the business, and, you know, one of the questions I get a lot is, okay, so you guys are good overnight as, you know, the Pistons, you were the worst team in the league last year, and now you're a playoff team. And, you know, how do you plan for that? Or what are some things, what are you seeing right away? And the reality is, not only what are we seeing right away, like if we, and it's unexpected. I had no idea that we were going to be a playoff team. I thought we would be better, but the plan in my mind was twofold. One, okay, if we're again a disappointing team, we're facing even more headwinds, right? This will be season four coming out of the pandemic being horrible. What's the narrative going to be for season five and beyond? And how do you storytell behind that, right? Storytelling is such a big part of what we do. Well, now that we're good, we also, that was part two. How, I'm always telling our team, we need to be ready. And the years we were in the lottery, I said, we need to be ready as if we're going to get the number one pick. And people thought I had lost my mind the year that Victor Wembanyama was part of the lottery. Transformational talent. And I was having our business plan as if we were going to get the number one pick, to the point where my vice president of sales and service, Amber Michkovia, comes into my office and she goes, is there something you're not telling me? Like, do you know that we're getting the number one pick? I was like, no, but obviously I'm doing a good job convincing you and the rest of the team. I have to have that conviction. Now, fast forward that May night where they do, it's May 17th, it's etched in my mind. Lottery comes, they pull out the envelope, we're the fifth pick. You could see a portion of my soul leave my body, but that was within minutes. And Elsie, you know, my wife's texting people at work, is Dan okay? Within 5 minutes, myself and one of my colleagues, we're pitching a partner that's there. Why jumping on now? There's never been a better time. So you need to be prepared for anything with the mindset of, how do we sustain this? What is something? And another one of the things that, you know, I often relay to people and different brands when we're talking about whether it's a renewal or even checking up prior to a deal sunsetting, is all deals, they don't age gracefully. There's times where you need to interject and maybe change the calculus a little bit on it. So again, I get passionate about this stuff because I love planning for all these unknown scenarios. I, you know, the other thing I like to joke with people is there's some things that I'm really good at. I don't have a crystal ball. Mind reading, you know, my dad used to always say to me, mind reading was a course that wasn't offered in college. And, you know, but can I be prepared? What does that preparation look like? And I think we try to extrapolate that throughout our organization.
And that is part of why I wanted you to come on today and talk about exactly this. Because folks, I mentioned this in the beginning, your ability to stay calm during really challenging moments, stressful moments, it always stood out to me. And you just gave the secrets to it, I think, which is preparation, right? I talk about the concept of leadership athlete and leadership as a sport. And you just, unprompted, gave that description. You are practicing every day. You're doing what it takes. You're preparing. And so then you can face those things with a much more calm, centered approach to it. It makes so much sense.
Yeah. It's funny you called me calm. I would say several years ago, people would say, hey, I had this really calm and even disposition. I've also been accused of being a keyboard warrior from time to time because I'm passionate about my ideas and stuff. So calm's a new one that I'm glad that I gave that off to you. I'm passionate. I never would ask anyone to do something that I don't firmly or passionately believe in. You can change my mind very easily. Like most, I really do enjoy the spirited dialogue back and forth. I do have conviction on that stuff. But yeah, adversity is going to hit. And, you know, I think that's probably, you know, I'm being a little self-deprecating with some of the stuff. But like, I do think having that kind of steadiness is super important because people feed off of that. You and I have both worked for leaders, some of which were as calm as could be. And you didn't know if the best thing had happened or the worst thing. And then we had some people in the organization where every single blip that went on, you would feel it. And if they were feeling stress or they were feeling disappointed or angry, that would push down the hill. So there's a couple different ways. And to me, I've always been a believer, I tend to learn more in really difficult times or if I don't want it replicated ever again. Like there's a couple people in my orbit where that I've either worked with, partnered with on something, and I go, oh, that was a really bad experience. But then I step back and I go, I contributed to that. I was there, right? Like, and I think a lot of that has helped personally make me better. And then those around me trying to create a better environment so they don't have to experience maybe what I did.
Yeah, I feel so much the same on everything you just said. And I was about to make a joke about the water on the bathroom counters, but that's a whole nother. But you know, you're right. It is actually steadiness. That's what I think is probably the best word is that you always had that sense of steadiness. And when you're that way, people know they can come to you. You're not going to fly off the handle. And it goes back to what Fred used to say is like, we will get through it together. And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about. You can get through it together, but I can't stress enough how important it is to scenario play. And a lot of times I'm like, okay, well, let's play devil's advocate, you know, And I'll always run through that before I run headstrong at something to say yes for sure. It's like, okay, well, let's play devil's advocate. But that way you do learn different tips and tricks for how to try to keep things as safe as possible, knowing that some shit's gonna blow up.
Yeah, I'll overshare. The playing devil's advocate, amazing for business. Yes. For those people that are listening that are married, not as good with your spouse. I get accused very often of always playing devil's advocate. And sometimes it's just shut up, listen, be a sounding board. Do not always play devil's advocate. So right on the
business. You have a wonderful, as I call her, lovely badass wife. The best of the best. Absolutely. Well, I'm just so glad that you spent time with us today. You've shared so many great nuggets and thanks for giving us a look inside to what's going on at the Pistons. Now that I too am back in my Michigan roots, you guys have my support for sure. And I just thank you so much for the way that you're leading and representing. It's awesome to see.
thanks so much for having me. And most importantly, thank you for the friendship over. We're coming up on almost 2 decades. You look the same. I just keep aging out. But no, it's wonderful to see you. Wonderful to catch up.
You're the best, Lefton. Have a great day. Everybody, thanks for joining.
Bye-bye.